A great debate is raging on the left between those whose first priority is defeating Trump and those who say supporting Joe Biden means selling out to corrupt corporate Democrats. Today, we bring that debate to Writer's Voice. First, we talk with political cartoonist Ted Rall about his book, Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Then, author and long-term socialist activist Max Elbaum asks, should anti-capitalists urge a vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump in 2020? We talk with him about his article by that title in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. The base of the Democratic Party is overwhelmingly progressive, supporting such programs as Medicare for All and the Green New Deal by large margins. But centrists like Tom Perez still run the DNC party apparatus, and they're reluctant to compromise with the party base. Intra-party warfare exploded into the open in 2016, and my guest, political cartoonist Ted Rall, says it's even bigger now. In his new book, Political Suicide, Rall argues that the civil war in the Democratic Party poses an existential threat to the two-party system. And it's a system he personally is fed up with. Rall says it's time for progressives to draw a line in the sand. If the Democratic Party continues to ignore and disparage its progressive base, that base should go elsewhere with its vote or stay home. Ted Rall is the author of numerous books, many of which he's discussed on this show. Ted Rall, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's great to be here.
This book is called Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Talk about that title.
Well, you know, I couldn't have possibly come up with a title that would be more pertinent to the current situation. You know, as an author, you always kind of want your book to be timely, but of course it takes like at least 6, 12, 18 or more months to conceive a book and then get it to press. So that doesn't usually happen. And that doesn't usually happen for me either. But here we are in the middle of a raging debate among progressive Democrats and liberal Democrats about whether or not to support Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And that's all part of this ongoing struggle between sort of the two main wings within the Democratic Party. This struggle goes back arguably 100 years or more to figures like Henry Wallace, but certainly for anybody who's say under 60 or 65, they will remember Ted Kennedy's insurgency against Jimmy Carter in the primary in 1980. They will remember Howard Dean, his insurgency in 2004 against John Kerry from the left. And of course, Bernie Sanders' two runs against a more establishment Democrat in 2020 in this cycle, as well as 4 years ago in 2016. And all of those kind of come down to a schism within the party. And the party is kind of known as the party of the working person, the working man and woman. I remember when I was a kid, my mom, who was a lifelong Democrat, told me, you know, the Democrats are the party of the working Jane and Joe. Republicans are the party of big business. So that was kind of a simple dynamic. And I think it was, kind of true, at least until the 1970s. And then starting in the late 1970s, the party started understanding that they could get large corporate donations, but obviously that was going to come at a cost of providing some access to these companies. And when a CEO gives you millions of dollars, they want you to take their calls if you happen to win with the money that you gave them. So the party basically now has arrived at the point where there's sort of a form of apartheid. Like South Africa was a country with a minority white government presiding over a majority black population. And in Democratic Party apartheid, you have a minority neoliberal corporatist DNC presiding over a dominant majority progressive base. Now, how you define progressive is, of course, a subjective matter, but about 72% of Democrats self-identify as progressives. And certainly, if you look at sort of, for example, the combined vote totals of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders in the current cycle, as well, and you add a little bit of the identity politics wing of supporters of figures like Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker, you're going to get well over 50% of the Democratic primary vote. And so they're fighting over what to do. And really it comes down to the neoliberal centrist wing always gets their way. They get their nominee, they get their policies. And so what they're trying to do is convince the progressives to come aboard, and the progressives have to decide whether they're going to come on board and join the anti-Trump wing of the party, much the way that they've joined the anti-Republican neoliberal wing of the party in every election until 2016, or if they want to replicate 2016 and do what they did then, which was 3 to 4 million Bernie Sanders voters stayed home in the general election, sat on their hands, which is an extraordinary figure because only about 12% to 8% of American voters participate in primaries. So those are fanatics. If you voted in a primary and you don't show up at the general election, it's not because of apathy. It's because you're making some sort of statement or you're just not interested in those two candidates. But the point is that that's kind of so the book kind of traces how we got where we are now. And it discusses going forward what progressives in particular are going to want to do.
Well, let's go back to Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter back then, as you point out, was not the progressive that he is now. I mean, it's actually rumored that he voted for Bernie in 2016, and he has certainly been a lot more progressive. So tell us about Jimmy Carter. Who was the real president, Jimmy Carter?
Well, that's an interesting, it's an interesting point because I think, Francesca, the thing we have to understand is that the party and the Republican Party have moved so far right that it's entirely possible that Jimmy Carter never really changed, but the Democratic Party did change. So what was a centrist Democrat in 1976 is really a progressive Democrat by 2020. And I think that's kind of what happened with Carter.
But he voted for Bernie, who I think we would argue is a progressive.
Bernie's clearly a progressive in the current context, but in the context of mainstream Democratic politics, he certainly would have been to the right of someone like George McGovern or Hubert Humphrey back. And Hubert Humphrey was obviously a mainstream Democrat in 1968.
How so? How would he have been to the right? Because he seems to be a pretty strong New Deal, FDR social Democrat who's always been talking about socialism and, has, for the most part, voted on the right side of history, whereas Hubert Humphrey, he went with the racist wing of, he's quite problematic, let's just say. I don't have it in my mind right now, but recently I read about how Hubert Humphrey, was really part of helping to suppress black people in the Democratic Party. Oh, yeah, it was in fact. And in the Mississippi Democratic, Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, that he tried to suppress it with Johnson.
Yeah, well, that's all true about Humphrey. I mean, maybe it would be fair to say that Bernie and Humphrey would be about equal. But my point, though, is that Carter was he's really the beginning of the rightward shift of the Democratic Party. People forget things like, his policies. This is a guy who, after the Vietnam War and the draft was eliminated, he brought back draft registration. He was a guy who started what we later came to know as the Reagan defense buildup. But he started it in 1978. Reagan only became president in 81. And Reagan himself said that he merely continued what Carter had begun. Carter was hawkish on Afghanistan. He took Brzezinski's advice to draw the Soviets into a Vietnam-style quagmire there by funding and arming the Mujahideen with sophisticated weapons. He boycotted the Olympics in Moscow, politicizing an event that was not supposed to be political. And he backed the Shah of Iran and welcomed him into the United States to seek medical care. That triggered the Iran hostage crisis. It is true that he didn't start any wars. That was unusual. It also is true that he prioritized human rights in his rhetoric and international affairs. But Carter, most notably for a Democrat, became the first Democrat of the post-New Deal era to not propose a single anti-poverty program. And this was at a time when a lot of Americans were suffering. Americans are suffering all the time. But in particular, there was the oil shock, OPEC crisis, inflation, pretty high unemployment. The fact that he didn't find it necessary to hit that spot, to even try to force the Republicans to vote no, is telling. And in fact, the no Democratic president, Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, since has proposed any anti-poverty program. That used to be a staple of Democratic politics. Carter sort of initiated what became known as sort of the third way Southern governor strategy. Bill Clinton was considered to be an echo of that. In a way, even though Obama was not a same type of figure and he was a senator, not a governor, he nevertheless also came out of what they call the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which is no more, but it is definitely the mentality of the party. And basically what it boils down to is that the party's interest is in running toward the center and trying to draw swing voters who might vote Republican in one election, Democratic in another. There's about 6% of American voters currently fit into that category. And so the conventional wisdom, at least not among Republicans, they don't believe in this at all. But Democrats believe that chasing those swing voters is what's going to make or break them in an election. It didn't work out in 2016, but they're hoping it'll work out in 2020.
You know, it's interesting. I do agree with you about Jimmy Carter, and you didn't even mention the Carter Doctrine, which was kind of the beginning of a lot of our policy toward trying to control the oil-producing countries of the Middle East in order to guarantee our oil. But I have a particular history with the Carter administration because I was working for the great designer of the OSHA Act, Tony Mazzocchi, at the time. OSHA was, at that point, a very important and progressive part of the government. Eula Bingham was the head of OSHA under Jimmy Carter. And, you know, often people don't think of this, but it is the people that a president appoints, as we've seen under Trump, who are really critical, you know, for the boots on the ground implementation of policy. Eula Bingham was quite progressive. Workers' rights on the job really made advances at that time. And then as soon as Reagan came in, we went into long years in the wilderness that only let up slightly under Bob Reich in the first Clinton administration, and then, you know, kind of went away again. So I say that because I think it's important to draw the differences where there are differences instead of just kind of lumping them all into the same. What can you say about the divisions in the ruling class that are kind of informing the current debate about where we should, you know, put our energies?
Well, that's a good question, right? I mean, like, there's the question of whether we should pursue electoral politics, street politics, or both at the same time. And I think what's going on in the ruling class division is, I mean, I think in a way there kind of isn't a division there that is relevant to working people anymore, because at this point, I think it's been made very painfully clear at the time of this interview, which is taking place right after the Democratic convention and during the Republican virtual convention. And you look at the Republican convention, the speaker lineup is all hard right Republicans. It's kind of a bunch of crazies, including the gun couple who pointed guns at peaceful protesters. And then the Democratic lineup, where AOC was only given 90 seconds to speak, and then they gave spots to Republicans like John Kasich and Colin Powell. They got to speak for much longer. And, you know, these are kind of horrible people. So it's just, it's very clear that the Democratic Party has decided to be charitable, that they're not going to kowtow to the left, and to be uncharitable, that they're going to snub the left. And basically, they're calculating that either they can win elections without the left or its donations or its votes, or they're thinking that they can give the left enough lip service just by saying, hey, you guys are part of us, please join us, or that they can be shamed into voting if you don't, as in, if you don't support us, you're voting for Trump. You know, it's like that old World War II poster, you know, when you ride alone, you ride with Hitler. And those are the choices, right? So that's where the DNC is. That's where the Democratic Party is. So progressives have to kind of decide, is this a vessel that we want to be part of? Is this someplace we want to expend our energies? And I know where I stand. I'm over it. I used to be a Democrat. I'm not anymore. My vote doesn't want to be where it's not wanted. You know, my vote is clearly not wanted in a party that doesn't have a single major policy matter spun from a political point of, from a progressive point of view. And it's certainly not wanted anywhere from two candidates who are from the right wing of the Democratic Party, or from two candidates who are not willing to even say that they would appoint a single progressive to their cabinet. Clearly, that they're expecting to get their votes from these sort of mythical swing voters, and you know, I wish them all the best. It might work. Who knows?
Well, that's interesting, Ted Rall, because in your book, Political Suicide, you say that the crisis that the establishment has gotten us into has given us an opportunity to remake the Democratic Party. And as you've just pointed out, there is a progressive majority. Democrats did win back already in 2018, half of the seats that they lost in previous years in the Obama, during the Obama administrations. We have a real resurgence of progressive candidates. Tonight, I'm going to be phone banking for Alex Morse. You know, I've been around doing these things for a very, very long time, and I think these are pretty exciting times for people, not just trying to win elections in the Democratic Party, but also outside groups like the Sunrise Movement, you know, who are working hard both inside and outside, inside for electoral politics and outside in street demonstrations. So at this time, you yourself say this gives us an opportunity to remake the party. Why are you deciding to sit this out?
Well, because there's no organization that's leading the way. We can't, at this point, there is no new left type movement with it that's either outside looking in to take over the Democratic Party, or a group of Democrats who have any kind of organization who are going to be able to make the kind of changes before November that one would need. I mean, it really wouldn't be that complicated. What you would want is an organization of millions of progressive and left-leaning Democrats to be able to say, look, we have this membership, and these people have all agreed to support the Democratic Party in exchange for the following demands, A, B, C. And if you choose to negotiate with us, then we will bring you these voters. But if you choose to ignore us, then they all promise to boycott the election. That would be incredible leverage. And I do think that would be an incredible opportunity. And I'm not saying, by the way, that that's the only way it could be done. That's just how I would do it. But the point is, there needs to be some kind of credible way to force the levers of power to move. And I just don't see that currently happening. Right now, what we have is just progressive voters as individuals are being either bullied or shamed or asked simply to give their votes away, but in exchange for nothing at all. You know, like, hey, are you going to have any progressive policy planks? No. Are you going to have any progressive candidates? No.
Well, that's not true. I mean, Ted Rall, come on. There's a climate plan that is actually by far the most progressive plan on climate that the Democrat, that Biden has. I'm not talking about the DNC, but the platform of the DNC doesn't really mean a whole lot. I mean, Biden has been very, very clear about his climate plan. And Kamala Harris, she has a lot of progressive bona fides when it comes to environmental concerns. And, you know, for many people, that's number one.
Well, it's number one for me, too. I think, you know, we live on the planet And if the planet's gone, we're not going to be having any discussions about any other issue. However, if you just read the Biden climate plan on the campaign's website, it is so Weasley that it is easy to see how people can get fooled. For example, it says things like the Green New Deal is a framework, but then it doesn't endorse the Green New Deal. And it goes on to say that it wants, its goal is zero carbon emissions by 2050. But climate experts say, famously, that there might not even be human civilization by 2050 due to climate change. I mean, I think it's a fair bet to say that many of us listening to this now will be dead. Joe Biden certainly will be dead by 2050 and in no position to push anything forward in a meaningful way. 2050 is meaningless.
Oh, he has intermediate goals. He has intermediate goals. In fact, he's got, I forget exactly, I think it's 50% by 2030. There are clear benchmarks. And climate is my thing. I have read it. And I've also read a lot of commentary about it from the climate activist community. And they are, including the Sunrise Movement, they were pleasantly surprised by how strong it was. So just because you say that this is 100% by 2050 doesn't mean that you're not making, and you're not committing to benchmark goals in between, which he has.
Well, I think, frankly, we're beyond the possibility of benchmark goals even having any effect. I mean, even the Green New Deal pushes for 100% carbon free or carbon neutral by 2030. And a lot of climate scientists say it may already be too late. In fact, even if we abolish the internal combustion engine tomorrow, it might already be too late. We're way out of time, like the Rolling Stones song said. And I think, I mean, we don't have any time for incrementalism anymore. And the other thing that this plan completely forgets is the existence of the Republican Party. I mean, what good does a plan do that has benchmarks that finally wind up in, 30 years from now, when you know that the next time that President Ted Cruz gets in or President Marco Rubio gets in, it'll all just be rolled back? We're at the stage now where we have to ram through radical changes all at once and on such a grand scale that A, it might have a chance of having an effect in time, because the Earth might be able to recover, and B, that it's going to be something that can't be easily reversed. It's got to be something that's passed as a law, not as a series of presidential executive orders. I think we're on the same page about where we want to end up. I just don't think that the Biden plan can possibly get us there. It sort of presupposes politics and climate change as usual, and neither of those is likely.
Well, let me ask you said before Ted Rall, and we are speaking with Ted Rall. His newest book is Political Suicide, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. You said recently that a lot of Bernie voters in 2016 did not vote for Hillary Clinton, and that, may have played a part in electing Donald Trump. Let me ask you, what do you think would happen to the climate and the climate movement under a second Trump administration? And do you feel that sitting out this election again might risk the same result it had last time?
Well, I do not think that the world is any worse off under Donald Trump than it would have been under Hillary Clinton. For every policy that you could look at, for example, border control, I think Hillary Clinton would have been marginally better.
No, but I'm asking about a second Trump term. I'm not comparing a first Trump term.
I don't think a second Trump term is nearly as much of a threat as a lot of liberals believe. First of all, second, you show me any president who got anything done in his second term and wasn't just mired in scandal. And I think you're going to have to go to like the 19th century. There's even FDR hardly got anything done in his second term. If you look at Reagan's second term, it was all about Iran-Contra. Clinton was all about Monica Lewinsky. Obama was just in a stalemate with the Republicans. None of them get anything done. And I don't see how this president, with his temperament and dysfunctional governing style, is going to succeed where FDR failed. So that's one. The other question is, Okay, so if we're weighing where Biden would take us, I think in the aggregate, you know, what would happen? I don't think Biden would improve enough to erase all the things that he would probably make worse. I mean, for one thing, he is has a long history of militarism, and I might be able to overlook that if he'd ever expressed any kind of regrets for his wars to invade Afghanistan and Iraq, the bombing of Bosnia, and so on. But he never has. And so therefore, you have to assume that he would do the same thing. He was in the room very recently in 2009, 2010, 2011, when the Obama administration decided to fund and arm radical jihadis in Syria and Libya, which blew up regional conflicts into massive civil wars that reduced Libya to a failed state where slavery is now legal. And Syria has been devastated. You know, that's, again, those were terrible decisions that Biden was part of. Again, he never expressed any kind of reservation about it. And I don't even think his border policy would be significantly better. It's really hard to point to any prompt. I mean, Biden hasn't even really specifically promised any radical improvements over what Trump is doing. What Biden has articulated is a lot of vague pablum about listening to the experts and having more competent cabinet members and so on. But I don't care about that crap. I want specifics. And I want to know exactly what it is that he would do that is better than this atrocious president. I mean, beating Donald Trump should be a very low bar. And instead, you know, it's funny, the Republicans just put through their non-platform, their platform boiled down to, in a couple of words, anything that Obama and Biden were for, we're against.
And white supremacy.
Trump's is literally, I mean, and Biden's platform is really long-winded. His promises are really long-winded, but they boil down to, I'm not Donald Trump. So we have these two candidates who are just like, I'm not the other guy. And I think progressives, one of the things that really distinguishes them is that they focus on things like the Glass-Steagall Act, and they remember them. They don't forget. Or student loan forgiveness. It's not like, oh, look over here, and then they'll forget. You know, they're $15 minimum wage. They don't forget. Medicare for all. They don't forget. So it's about policies for progressives. And they don't care that Kamala Harris would make history as the first woman of color vice president. You know, they care about policy, policy, policy.
And I think, you know, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I think you're absolutely right that progressives care about policy, and progressives really, really hope that they have a chance to fight over that policy and to fight for those policies in the next administration, something that they fear would not be possible under Donald Trump. Ted Rall, your latest book, Political Suicide, it's a great read, The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Francesca. It was great.
Ted Rall is one of America's preeminent political cartoonists. He's the author of numerous books, including graphic biographies of Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, Edward Snowden, and Pope Francis. He's a frequent guest on Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for links to Rall's blog and to previous interviews with him on the show. Next up, we talk with a radical socialist about why the strategic move for the left at this time is to vote for Biden. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Max Elbaum has been an anti-capitalist activist since the 1960s. I know that because Max and I go way back, all the way to SDS and the anti-war movement of that time. He's written extensively about the New Left, the Civil Rights Movement, and the anti-war movement, including in his book, Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che. So when Elbaum wrote a recent post on the website Organizing Upgrade, urging a vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump, he wasn't coming from the centrist wing of the Democratic Party. Far from it. But he says voting for Biden is a strategic choice for the left, that defeating fascist or white supremacist authoritarian control of the executive branch and the Supreme Court is necessary to protect the growing left movement. Elbaum's post on the website Organizing Upgrade is titled, Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in 2020? Welcome, Max Elbaum, to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks very much, Francesca.
So in the interest of full disclosure, you and I have known each other since the 1970s, 1960s even possibly, the end of the 60s. We were both students in the glory days of the movement in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, that was a really exciting time. And the bonds formed between activists then have lasted a long time, including ours.
That's for sure. I wanted you to come on to the show to talk about, well, you've written a number of things, but I really want to focus on what I think is possibly one of the best, if not the best, article about the whole should socialists support Biden debate. It's called Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or Not? And this appeared on the website Organizing Update. So before we kind of dive into the article itself, just give us a brief description. Tell us what Organizing Update is all about.
Organizing Upgrade has been around for a little more than a decade. But this is a second iteration of the project started in 2017. It's a group of activists from different parts of the country and different social movements, although primarily rooted in the racial justice and community organizing world, and came together to have a website that would discuss political strategies for those sectors of the movement and beyond. In non-electoral work, grassroots organizing, as well as electoral work, with a focus on centering racial justice, fighting the right wing, and building a durable, long-term progressive movement that takes up all the struggles for economic justice, gender justice, peace, and international solidarity. It's not connected to any particular political organization, but we identify with the broad current of the community organizing world, Movement for Black Lives, Working Families Party, Black Voters Matter, those kinds of organizations, and have published different things covering their work over the last period.
So you start out talking about how the 2020 election is going to determine which force is going to hold governing power. What are the two forces that you see as being in battle at this point?
The country right now seems polarized more so than at any time, certainly since the 60s when we were active, but arguably since the period of the Civil War. The polarization is a partisan political polarization, a racial polarization, geographic polarization, and even a basic information polarization, as the different sides get their facts and interpretations from almost two different information systems. And I would describe the polarization as between the bloc united behind Donald Trump that's pushing a racist authoritarian agenda, and a much more diverse but larger anti-Trump majority that has different forces, but all for different reasons, see Trump as an existential threat to their interests, and for the progressive wing of the anti-Trump coalition as the main obstacle to advancing the kind of radical social change, structural change that's needed in the country and that's been especially revealed as important because of the pandemic and more recently, the uprising to defend Black lives.
So these two forces, one is being driven by white supremacy. The other is united by its anti-Trumpism. And that anti-Trumpism is about what you're saying here, is about not only supporting racial justice, whatever that may mean. It may mean quite different things within that coalition, but also more broadly to protect some democratic norms. Is that correct?
Yes. The interrelationship between the struggle for democratic space, maximum democratic rights, and the struggle for social change and radical socioeconomic change, that's always been a very controversial issue on the left, but they're very interrelated. Without the democratic space to be able to organize and contend for political power, the prospects for building the kind of movement that can eventually lead and govern the country from a radical point of view are very small. So the defense of democratic rights and maximum democratic space is part of our tasks, although that in itself does not solve the underlying socioeconomic, political economy problems that we're facing.
Yeah, and so I'd like to talk next about kind of the two wings of the progressive movement, both of which came together behind Bernie's campaign. And before we get into their reaction to Biden, first, talk a bit about what Bernie's movement did accomplish and then what it didn't, what it left undone.
Well, Bernie's campaign in 2016, which built upon Occupy and the concept of the 1%, the 99% versus the 1%, built on some of the momentum that the Black Lives Matter movement had, the climate movement, the climate justice movement, that put radical ideas onto the agenda. And his campaign in 2020 took them even further. So Bernie's campaign centered around economic justice, Medicare for all, a lot of ideas that were considered radical or marginal back even 5 years ago have become mainstream. As Bernie put it, he won the ideological fight within the Democratic Party in the primaries this year, although he lost the electability fight. But the whole tenor of the conversation around health care, around a Green New Deal, around racial and gender justice, even around somewhat around foreign policy, although that's been a weaker front of the resistance. Bernie deserves a lot of credit. And his campaign, with the spirit of not me, us, was a big factor, not only in changing the discourse, but in bringing a lot of candidates into politics, particularly women of color, who've been elected now to all levels, city councils, state legislatures, the squad in Congress, and now the squad expanding in size, Cori Bush's victory in St. Louis, other important victories in New York and other states. So the landscape has changed, and Bernie's campaigns have a substantial credit for that. There were shortcomings in Bernie's campaigns, and so he wasn't perfect, but we don't expect perfection. He made things a lot better, and he's playing a very crucial role right to this moment, focusing on the kind of relief that's needed under COVID-19, as well as the electoral struggle in November.
We're talking with Max Elbaum of Organizing Upgrade about his article, Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or Not? So talk about these two wings of, let's say, the Democratic Socialist with a small DS, not big DS, you know, people who identify as Democratic Socialists, but not necessarily with the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. And talk about the two wings, those who are working within an anti-Trump coalition to fight for a greater influence of progressive programs, working class oriented programs, a multicultural working class movement, and those who say you can't cooperate with electoral politics in the U.S. because these are just two wings of the corporate class.
Well, Bernie's campaign, and let's approach that via the differences that existed within Bernie's campaign and then what sort of popped out as soon as Bernie withdrew. Most people who supported Bernie's campaign, the broad mass, were excited about his program. Medicare for All, Green New Deal, Not Me, Us, and his critique of the establishment, his critique of the injustices within the system. you know, especially since the economic crisis of 2008 and bailouts and all that. But for socialists and for people who were anti-capitalist within Bernie's campaign, people looked at it in two different ways, and Bernie sent some mixed signals. So, you know, part of his campaign was railing against the billionaire class and the establishments in both parties. And it seemed from that there were sectors of the socialist, democratic socialist movement that saw Bernie as running basically against the establishments equally of both parties. The fact that he was running for the Democratic Party nomination was just a temporary tactical thing, and that perhaps Bernie himself or a large section of his base would break off from the Democrats and form a new party if he didn't get the nomination. The other signal was sent by Bernie's constant refrain that Trump was the most dangerous president in modern American history, that defeating Trump was essential, and that he would support whoever the nominee in the Democratic Party was in order to beat Trump. And those socialists who identified with that point of view and saw that signal were essentially thinking in terms of an anti-fascist front. One can discuss the language about whether Trump is a fascist or an authoritarian racist or, you know, exactly what that is. But that particular wing of the socialist movement and Bernie's signal was that we would be part of a broader coalition where we would have to unite with forces that we don't agree with on the long-range strategy that would be our enemies somewhere down the road. But under the current set of circumstances, it was essential to eliminate the main obstacle to any kind of social change, climate change denialism, white nationalism, having its grip on executive power. And those two points of view could pretty easily coexist within Bernie's campaign while it was a live campaign, because we all supported Bernie Sanders. And we were critical of Biden and the other candidates from the so-called moderate or corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And we were pushing for Bernie to get the nomination and lead the struggle in 2020. And there was a lot of excitement after Nevada that Bernie won, and it looked like he was the front runner. And things went downhill very quickly in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday. And Bernie was pretty much pushed to the bottom and out of the race. And at that point, the different socialist interpretations of what a correct strategy would be of how to move forward in 2020 all popped to the surface. And the debate started to come out, and not always in the best way, because people were still reeling from trying to absorb what had happened about how a campaign that was a front-runner campaign just in a matter of weeks could crash. So those two ideas clashed. And Bernie himself moved very quickly, became clear that his point of view was to be part of an anti-right-wing, anti-Trump front. He endorsed Biden. He set up joint task forces with Biden and began to try to influence the direction of the campaign and made an agreement with Biden that Biden would allow him to play some role in shaping his Biden administration policies. So the forces who were in that camp in the socialist movement had a fairly smooth transition to figuring out, throwing themselves into the campaign against Trump and figuring out how to do their work in that campaign, not as part of Biden's official campaign, but setting up independent structures that would campaign to defeat Trump, but would bring the people that they would reach into the orbit of the progressive grassroots organizations that had a longer range view than just beating Trump and thinking everything would be okay. The other forces, the people who had a different point of view, had a more complicated dilemma, because there was not a substantial move, given especially how dangerous people in the labor movement and the Black community saw Trump. There was no large-scale motion to break off from the Democrats and form a new party or support the Greens. So those folks more or less decided that they would put their energy into down-ballot races or non-electoral struggles. but sit out, take no collective position. Some individually would decide how they would vote, but take no collective position on the presidential contest.
I wonder what you think of the idea that possibly the Never Biden folks are misconstruing the stage of development of the left movement in this country. I mean, you and I are both old enough to remember when there was an ascendant left on the anti-war front, but then the many, many years of severe marginalization. I mean, I can remember when you couldn't even use the term capitalism without people looking at you as if you were some kind of communist. And now people are very comfortable talking, even in the mainstream, about neoliberalism. And the change in views on Black Lives Matter, for example, have been astonishing. As you pointed out, you know, the Overton window has really moved considerably to the left, but that's just one stage, a critical one. I mean, think how many decades it took the right wing to overtake the New Deal politics. I mean, decades of changing the ideological landscape. So I wonder if you could weigh in just on, you know, where are we in terms of power and the difference between ideological power and institutional power?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's been a very fluid period, and there's certainly a radicalization, especially among young people. And all kinds of ideas are in the mainstream now that are more radical. And there's a tremendous sympathy for systemic change, or even under the name socialism, among new generations. But the institutional strength of those ideas, how much clout they can actually wield, how many voters they can mobilize, what institutional forms can they exercise power in, that lags behind. So it was a very interesting situation. Bernie's campaign ran way ahead of the underlying institutional infrastructure of the progressive and social justice movements, not to speak of the anti-capitalist left. So it wasn't a case, for example, where large socialist organizations or radical groups were driving the campaign and then they found a candidate who might support their points of view. It worked the other way. Bernie was way out ahead of where the institutional structure of the left was. And that's still the case. And that's the principal reason why Bernie didn't win the nomination. Because even large numbers of people who supported his ideas did not believe that he was the most electable candidate, and their connections were still to the moderate wing, the establishment wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, the main example of that is African Americans in the South, who were decisive in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday in giving the nomination to Biden. That's the sector of the U.S. population that has the most vivid memory of Jim Crow. It has the most vivid memory of the civil rights movement and what gains were accomplished. And it's the sector of the U.S. population that's experienced the rollback in terms of the Southern states' anti-union policies, anti-misogynistic, anti-reproductive rights policies, economic policies, as well as the direct racial policies. And that layer of the population is supportive of radical change, but very concerned with defeating Trump. And Bernie and the left was not a known factor in many of those communities, whereas they didn't know the more mainstream politicians, if you want to use that term, and Biden was a familiar face to them. So we lost that struggle. And it takes years, as you said, Francesca, it takes years to match radical ideas with the kind of infrastructure of grassroots organizations that can make you a political force. So the left has maybe a half a dozen to a dozen people in Congress now. We have people scattered in cities and state legislatures. We're even electing some district attorneys. But we're not a dominant force yet. And we have to take that into account when we look at what the stakes are with a white nationalist, climate denialist, reactionary who's now trying to destroy the post office and all that in the White House.
Yes, exactly. And of course, the other big thing is, you know, we can talk about how long it took the conservatives to gain that kind of institutional power. And they, what they had in their favor was the oligarchy. We're in a much more oligarchic situation now. So that the movement that we're talking about is not just fighting for recognition, let's say. I think it's been successful beyond my wildest dreams when it comes to recognition in such a swift time period, but is also fighting against an entrenched ruling class that has only become more powerful in these decades. But you point to some splits in that ruling class. So I wonder if you could, first of all, talk about those splits and then how the left might be able to exploit them.
Well, the Trump administration has decided its fossil fuel backers. It's driven by the most reactionary sections of the ruling class, the fossil fuel industry, the military industrial complex, and the whole cohort of right-wing billionaires. And they built a social coalition based on the idea that white supremacy has to be reinforced because otherwise, the changing demographics of the country are going to remove them from power. I mean, Trump and the Republicans have explicitly said, if everybody gets to vote, we'll never win another election, which is why they're moving toward authoritarian rule and a sort of new form of apartheid, second-class citizenship for people of color, voter suppression, disenfranchisement, and all kinds of other things. So that coalition views a certain kind of authoritarianism as absolutely indispensable for their interests. Now, another wing of the ruling class doesn't agree with that. They think that that's highly unstable, that in the changing demographics, you can't build a stable ruling capitalist system based upon a narrow white base that has to be ginned up all the time into hatred and fear-mongering. They think it's the elimination of U.S. soft power around the world, as the U.S. has been able to position itself as a democracy, as for human rights, and so on. And they're also personally threatened by the kind of mafia-type state that Trump has been implementing. I mean, he wants to throw Hillary Clinton in jail. He wants to throw Jeff Bezos in jail. It's a totally corrupt type system where all the funds go to his cronies and so on. And he wants to intervene in the economy to favor not the capitalist class overall, but his particular favorites. And that's not a stable system. That's a sign of political weakness. So there's a section of the ruling class, but that for that mix of reasons, as well as some of them individually, are not happy with the extreme crudeness of the bigotry, homophobia, and so on of the Trump administration. So you see this incredibly bitter partisan battle. And that is an opening for us. You know, when a ruling class is united, they're very hard to defeat. But what you learn on the playground as a kid is you let your enemies fight, and you don't fight all your enemies at once if you want to survive in a difficult situation. So that division in the ruling class is something we can exploit. And especially now that we, per the last discussion we just had, we're certainly not a dominant force, but we're a rising force. More and more people are coming to support ideas. A lot of the dynamism and enthusiasm is with the progressive wing. So they've made some concessions. They've moved on to some issues. So we have some leverage that we didn't have before, and we have to use it as best we can, both to defeat the main enemy and to position ourselves so that we're stronger in the contention with people that we're now allied with but are going to be fighting against on January 21st. If Biden wins, we're going to have a complicated relationship where the Trump people aren't going to go away and we'll still have to fight them, but we'll also be fighting against the administration. As many people have said in elections in the United States, you get to pick your opponents. It's not that you're voting for people who are going to be our saviors, but you're getting to vote for who in the government is going to be your opposition. And who would you rather fight, the white nationalist authoritarians or people like Biden who have a different politic?
Yes, and you actually say that throwing ourselves into that anti-Trump coalition is the best route for building the strength of progressive movements and the socialist left. Tell us how we do that.
Well, you know, the largest number of people in our core constituencies that we have to reach to make social change, the African-American community, indigenous communities, other people of color communities, immigrant communities, the Latino communities, which are now the largest non-supposed racialized group in the United States. It's not white. The labor movement, women, young people, in largest numbers, those social sectors see Trump as a grave threat. In one of the webinars I saw the other day, Jessica Byrd from the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Justice Project, when asked about stance on the election, she said, well, what we've been hearing from black people is that Trump is going to kill us. Our lives are at stake. Mi Gente has one of the largest main organizations driving the Latino immigrant rights movement, has a Dump Trump campaign. This is a sentiment in that community. So if the left's message is, we're going to stand with you in that fight, we're going to be in the foreground of helping beat Trump, and we're going to go on from there, that's a message that resonates. If your message is, Biden isn't good enough for us, so we're sitting out the election. You all can go vote against Trump, but we're not going to spend any energy in that. We're going to come back into the fight when we have somebody we like better. That's not a message that's going to resonate with those constituencies. You know, Trump just invited those two people who brandished guns at the Black Lives Matter peaceful protests in St. Louis to speak at the Republican National Convention. So what signal is he sending? He's sending the signal, okay, you white homeowners in the suburbs, get your guns and get out there and be ready because the blacks are coming to take your house. This is straight out of Jim Crow. This is straight out of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, is our message going to be, we're against that. We got to get that out of office. It doesn't mean Biden is going to eliminate racism, but he's not going to be calling for white people to get their guns out and brandish them at peaceful protesters. So we need a message that talks about defeating Trump as being one stage of a longer struggle. And that's the message that the grassroots groups that have dug into electoral work in the last 4 or 5 years, Florida New Majority, Pennsylvania Stands Up, the Working Families Party, the different PACs and CPD Action, Center for Popular Democracy Action, People's Action, Black Voters Matter, Mi Gente. That's the message that these groups are sending because it's in touch with where the base of progressive-minded people are at. And by throwing themselves into the fray, they're expanding their own base. They're not expanding the number of people who are joining Democratic Party clubs or signing up to give money to Biden. They're giving money and signing up to be members of those organizations that are committed to fighting for power on a state-by-state basis come after November and January.
Well, Max Elbaum, that is a great point to end on. Your article is, should anti-capitalists urge a vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or not? I'd say that the answer to that is a ringing yes, but then the struggle continues. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me, Francesca. We've been together for 57 years, and let's hope we keep going and see some more victories.
Max Elbaum is the author of the 2018 book, Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che, and he's founder of the website Organizing Upgrade. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.